You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Lindsay Hogg has worked in almost every entertainment medium. On film, he directed Let It Be. On stage, The Normal Heart and Agnes of God. And for television, Brideshead Revisited. And he's generally credited with inventing the music video. He's the son of actress Geraldine Fitzgerald. And although she was married to the English baronet Edward Lindsay Hogg at the time of his birth, there were rumors from a very early age that he had a much more famous father. His memoir, Luck and Circumstance, tells the story of his remarkable life and the burning questions of his paternity. It's published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. I'm very glad to be here.
Thank now, you. Now, Love and Circumstance, not Pomp?
Luck and Circumstance. Love, Luck and Circumstance. No, not Pomp, but it could have been Luck and Circumstance and Coincidence, because all those things have played a part in my life.
Well, you have had a very interesting life, but reading this book, I understand what the Chinese mean when they say, may you live in interesting times, as a curse.
Yes, because like anybody's life, my life has had good luck in it, but also bad luck. I tend to emphasize the good luck part.
So as a child, what were you told about your parents?
Well, not much to start with, because I grew up in California. My mother was under contract to Warner Brothers. And her husband at the time, Edward Lindsay Hogg, left us to go back to Ireland, which was neutral in World War II. And so my mother, there wasn't a father around. And
no, but why did he do that? Was the marriage floundering?
Well, I think partly. And also because as an Irish citizen, he was able to go back to Ireland. And after Pearl Harbor, any resident alien was apt to be drafted, and he didn't think he'd be a good soldier.
So did you have much of a relationship with him? Did you ever go to Ireland to be
with him? Oh, yeah, but not a lot. After the war, he never came back to America once he left. And then after the war, every 2 years or so, my mother would go to Ireland to see her parents, and then I'd see him. So every couple of years, and then I was, when I was in my teens, I didn't see him for 5 years.
When do you first remember hearing that he might not, in fact, have been your father?
Well, that was funny. I wanted to be an actor in my teens. And my mother, the previous year when I was 15, before this particular occasion, had been in King Lear with Orson Welles at City Center. And he'd allowed me to watch all the rehearsals. I came to the conclusion that Michael Lindsay Hogg was not a particularly good name for an actor. But sometimes people wouldn't pronounce it properly. It had a hyphen in it. They sometimes would say Hogue, thinking Hogg would be rude, but it is Hogg, like pig. And so I was in my room one night putting down alternative names for myself, stage name. And then I wrote down Michael Wells. And I thought, oh, that's got a nice ring to it. So I went down to see my mother, and I said, what about Michael Wells? And she said, what for? I said, my stage name. And she said, I'm not sure that's a good idea. And I said, why not? And she said, well, you see, the thing is, when Orson and I were working at the Mercury Theater together, we were both very young, some people think we had an affair and that he's your father.
Huh.
Some people think that they had an affair and that he's your father. Then she said, but it's not true, of course. And I'd never mentioned it to you before because I didn't think it mattered. But then she went on to tell me a kind of strange account of one night when she and Orson were going to elope and go to a motel in New Jersey. And there was a kiss in the back seat of the car. And she wasn't sure if they were destined to be lovers. As though they'd never kissed before, I thought to myself later. If they hadn't kissed, why had Orson booked a taxi in a hotel room in New Jersey? But my mother denied it always. And over the years, people would sometimes come to me and say, is it true that Orson Welles is your father? I'd say, my mother says I'm not. I don't know. My mother always brought me up to believe that she was truthful, which in hindsight was probably a smart move on her part, since I loved my mother very much, but I think she probably made deals with herself the way some people do, and that it was important for her to have a tidy version of events.
Well, it's also easier for you to just let it lie, but why did they ask you? There is a physical resemblance. You don't look much like the baronet.
No, Edward Lindsay Hogg was tall and handsome, but his looks we're more like Jeremy Irons, say,
lean, good-looking.
Yeah. Whereas I, all my life, weight has been a problem, which I had to deal with. And also my face is kind of round, and I've got kind of different kind of eyes. I do have a resemblance to Orson, but also to my mother. And then I worked with him when I was 20 or so in a theater production of Chimes at Midnight, which we did in Ireland. And he took a very kind interest in me. And although we would have our rows sometimes, he took me out for dinner every night and treated me not like he probably was treating any other of the young actors in the company.
But you do seem to remember any kind of contact you had with him and with your father, your official father. You write about Edward Lindsay Hogg reaching down and taking your hand at one time. And I got the feeling that you had a longing for a father figure when you were a boy. Weren't there any men around who acted like a father figure for you?
After the war, my mother married my stepfather, Stuart Sheftel, who was a very decent man. And he took on the sort of emotional burden of being as a father. We didn't get on always, partly, I think, because there had been no man in my life as a boy, from one till, except for occasionally with Edward Lindsay Hogg, from the time until I was born till I was six, there was no constant man. It was World War II. A lot of the men were at war. But there wasn't anyone that I could have as a mentor. There were some friends, but no one consistent. And I think one of the things that kids need is something consistent. And so when my stepfather married my mother, he was the new man in our life, and consequently, I didn't want a new man in our life. I wanted my mother still.
But you didn't have your mother for a while as well.
After no,
born,
no, that was...
You didn't have a mother or a father as a small child.
No, sad. My mother, I think the reason my mother wasn't around so much is she was under contract to Warner Brothers, and that meant leaving our place at 5 in the morning to be in makeup at 5:30, and she'd be home at 8 o'clock at night, so she never was around that much because she was the one who was earning the living.
Did you have a feeling that she was frustrated as an actress? She was a great actress, and she was stuck in the studio system and often in parts that were beneath her talent.
Yeah. You know, recently, promoting Luck and Circumstance, I've been looking at some of her old films, particularly Wuthering Heights, and there are two scenes in there, one with Merle Oberon and one with Laurence Olivier, in which she's beautiful, very good and heartbreaking. Laurence Olivier said to me around the time of Brides Had Revisited that he thought my mother had completely stolen Wuthering Heights from everybody. So then I see this young woman, this very talented young woman, and then for some reason it all goes off the rails, her career. And I think it was terribly frustrating for her. And I think it was a source of kind of grief to her.
My guest is Michael Lindsay Hogg, who's written a memoir called Luck and Circumstances, A Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond. It's published by Knopf. So you were left with some woman who wasn't a nanny, and your mother was concerned that she might even be a little too harsh with you.
Mm. Yes, it was weird that when my mother was pregnant, she was in New York, and she was walking along Fifth Avenue one day, and she bumped into the Irish woman who'd been my mother's nurse, attendant, companion. And my mother had been very frightened of her when she was a little girl, my mother. And nevertheless, knowing that she, my mother, wouldn't be able to look after me full time, she hired Mary to be my nurse, my attendant, my person who really was like my mother. And she loved me very much, I know that, but she came from a stern and difficult background herself, which was Northern Ireland in the late or the early part of the 20th century. And she had a very, very big belief in God. And I remember she tucked me in bed one night, and I was about 7, and she said, "Don't you worry, Michael, you'll be all right." And I said, "Well, who won't be all right?" And she said, "Well, your mother and your father." And I said, "Well, why won't they be all right?" And she said, "They're going to go to hell because they've been divorced."
Wonderful thing to say to a kid. But you seem to have loved her, I guess, because she still was the closest thing to a parent figure. Mm-hmm. Your mother once asked you, when you were an adult, if you were a masochist. Did she worry because of Mary?
Yeah, I think it was a very funny conversation. I was in my 30s, and my mother was making some supper for herself. My stepfather was out. And my mother said, something's been worrying me. And I said, yeah, what's that? And she said, are you a masochist? I said, you know, you think, what? And I said, what kind of masochist do you mean? A physical masochist? And my mother said, yeah, a physical masochist. And I said, no. I mean, if anything, the reverse. And then my mother said, oh, thank God. And I thought, is she saying thank God that I'm not a masochist, or I might be somewhat the reverse of a masochist? And it was all to do with how Mary had treated me when I was growing up, which I don't remember. I suppose I've got a fabulously good memory, but I might have edited those things
out. So she was
out.
Stewing on that for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, do you think that you were born to go into the business? Because whenever you were with your mother, it was show business related. You went to rehearsals with her when you were young.
I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't found what you might broadly call the theater as a place for me to work. I was a very out of it kid. I couldn't read till I was almost nine. I was very overweight. And I had no sense of there being any place in the world for me. And it was when my mother invited me to come to rehearsal, as just to get me out of the house, to stop me moping in my room on a school holiday. And we went down. She was rehearsing The Doctor's Dilemma with Roddy McDowall, directed by the great dynamo Sidney Lumet, who was fresh from television then and his movie career hadn't started. And I felt for the first time in my life that there might be a place for me, a place where people were hard at work, but they were united in this endeavor. They were good-humored. Long hours didn't matter. And there seemed to be a kind of family feeling to the work they were doing. And I wanted to be part of that family.
Now, your mother talked about masochists. She turned down great roles. She turned down the opportunity to be in The Maltese Falcon.
Yeah.
I guess every actress has a story like that. We hear Ingrid Bergman turning down some pretty great roles as well.
They didn't. She turned down The Maltese Falcon because she was a great friend of Olivia de Havilland. And I think Olivia de Havilland might have had some sort of relationship with John Huston. I think my mother thought maybe he hadn't treated her friend that well. And so she had a kind of high moral dudgeon about that. She also turned down Rebecca because she didn't like Hollywood. And she had a deal in her contract that she could have 6 months in Hollywood and 6 months away.
I remember when Chimes at Midnight was released, Bosley Crowther told Orson Welles, don't open it here because I will destroy it. Why was that film so controversial? And how did you wind up working on it?
Well, I worked in the stage play. What he did was, it was a version of Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, which he'd originally done at the Mercury. And he'd put the two plays together.
It's really the Falstaff story.
Yeah, it's the Falstaff story. It's Falstaff and Hal. And so I did the stage production, which had all its adventures, which are in the book. And then Orson obviously wanted to reprise it, and he wanted Keith Baxter, who was the wonderful Prince Hal in it, to do the movie. I don't know. Well, I know they ran out of money, like they did on all of Orson's pictures. And, you know, he'll have a shot. I mean, John Gielgud, you know, his contract was up and he had to go back to England. And there'll be a long shot of someone playing King Henry, but it won't be John Gielgud, but it'll be someone sounding like John Gielgud. If that's not the exact story, it's something like that. I don't know why. Of course, many people regard it as one of his late classics.
Yeah, I thought it was a brilliant film.
Yeah,
it's just beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
Well, you wound up starting, your big breakthrough was quite different, wasn't it? It was Ready, Steady, Go, your first real professional break?
Yeah. That's the luck part of the title of the book, I think. Ready, Steady, Go was a live, on-the-air rock and roll television show.
How did you wind up doing that?
Luck.
Did you like rock and roll?
Loved it. Loved it. From the time I first heard Elvis Presley, Heartbreak Hotel, I felt there was some kind of music for me in the world.
So what was the format of the show?
The format of the show was the performers doing their songs. But one of the things about Ready, Steady, Go, not only was it live on the air, but we had live sound. So the musicians would come on and they wouldn't have to mime to their hit record. They could play two or three songs. And the times being what they were, the bands we had on were regularly the Rolling Stones, the Who, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, people like that. And
But the Beatles also.
The Beatles had slightly gone into more rarefied air even by then, but they would come on as guests. But playing regularly were the Rolling Stones and the Who. And I think where I was again lucky is I was more or less the same age. When I first met Mick Jagger, I was 24 and he was 21. And most of the other people who were directing these kind of shows, and in America too, Shindig and Hullabaloo, were older people, and they didn't think rock and roll would last. They thought it was going to be like the hula hoop. And the other thing that Ready, Steady, Go did, I think, was the other shows tried to contain the chaos of rock and roll to make it kind of tame, whereas we on Ready, Steady, Go embraced the chaos. Mm-hmm. And the musicians liked that and understood that.
And you wound up with making the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which is now available on DVD. But then you worked on Let It Be. Did you direct that film?
Yes, I did. What had happened was I directed a couple of early videos with the Beatles, Paperback Writer and Rain. And then a few years, then I did the Rolling Stones' first one.
This is in the early days of music videos.
It was the earliest days of music videos. There may have been a few before, and there obviously some in America.
Well, there had been those movie
Scoopy
shorts.
Tone, yeah. Scoopy Tone, which you could play in a bar, like at a pinball machine or something like that. I did the Rolling Stones' first, Johnny J. Flash. I did their videos for 15 years. Then I did two with the Beatles, Revolution and Hey Jude. As a result of that, the Beatles asked me to do what was meant to be a television special. But we fought so much about what it was going to be, it ended up being a documentary, which is Let It Be, which ends with the Great Rooftop Concert, which is the last time they ever played to any kind of public.
So it was kind of like a farewell film.
But we didn't know it, but it was.
And now your career is developing in London as a result of this?
Yes. I lived in London for 20 years. I'm Irish and American, and I had worked in Ireland too. And then I began to go into dramatic television. And in those years, the very best playwrights were writing for English television because there wasn't much of a movie industry. And so I did, you know, Tom Stoppard's first and only television play because those were the quality of writers you had writing at that period.
Did Bride's Head later?
Yes.
But you also developed a friendship with Peter Bogdanovich, who was a good friend of Orson Welles. This thing keeps on circling around to Orson
Welles. I know.
Welles. And a listener wants to know if you ever did a DNA test.
What a very interesting question. I've talked about DNA. The hardest DNA to pull is potential half-siblings, unless you have any genetic evidence from the father or the mother. I have none. Orson was cremated. Edward Lindsay Hogg was cremated. My mother was buried, and I did call up her dermatologist to see if he'd kept any skin samples, but he didn't. He'd thrown them away. She'd been dead too long. And it's the one which is the most inconclusive. But it really, in a funny way, the book isn't about only my mother and Orson and me. The book turns into kind of a mystery story. And everything I know, I take the audience with me, the reader with me. And so the reader, when he gets to the page before the end, will know exactly what I know in the way I learned it. And that's good enough for me.
You did take a hair sample from Edward Lindsay Hogg.
I did. It wasn't nothing, they couldn't pull anything from it.
Gloria Vanderbilt was a close friend of your mother's. And you had a relationship?
Yes. I'm very proud to say that many years ago now, that she and I went out together for a while. She's an extraordinary woman.
Was your mother okay with that?
Yeah. My mother was okay with most things. And I was okay with it, and I hope Gloria was okay with it. She's an extraordinary woman.
Well, and she also told you that she thought that Orson Welles was your father.
This is the, you know, luck and circumstance and coincidence. She sent me a book that she'd written, Obsession, a very interesting book. And then I sent her a draft of my memoir. And then she wrote back very nice things about it. And I suddenly thought, hey, my mother and Gloria were very great friends, intimate friends. And maybe there weren't many people left who knew my mother. My mother died at the age of 95 years ago. Gloria might have had some confidences with my mother. And that's when I got in touch with Gloria. And that's when Gloria revealed what she did.
In writing a memoir, you have to decide what to leave in, put in, what to leave out. Mm. Did you feel that there were still some secrets you had to keep?
I feel
I'm not going to ask you to reveal them now.
Yeah, there. I'd say there are. I'd say there are. But the thing about a memoir is, like a life, is when you look at it objectively, you look at how to make order out of it, because life can be a very messy thing. But I tried in the book to make order out of it, and I tried to show my memories in a way which should be clear to the reader and entertain the reader. You know, Rolling Stones, Beatles, Brightside, we visited Agnes of God, Larry Kramer's hand grenade of a play, The Normal Heart. Mm. And then these interesting mystery stories. Because the real thing about writing about your life, we all have our lives and our families. And the book is, as much as anything, is about connections. Connections missed and connections made to do with family.
Michael Lindsay Hogg, you left out Whose Life Is It Anyway?
Yes.
On Broadway. You left out Nasty Habits, Frankie Starlight, The Object of Beauty, Waiting for Godot. The book has lots of illustrations, which make it even more fun. And it's called Luck and Circumstance, Coming of Age in Hollywood, New York, and Points Beyond, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
I've loved it. Thank you. Great for me.